Good afternoon. Are we there yet? I indulge myself first in a few reactions to the very interesting discussion about genomics into which I happened to walk, because that discussion, stimulating as it was, propagated what I think is something of a false dichotomy, namely the notion that we need to choose one of these two kingdoms as prevailing over the other. There's a whole line of research now addressing what's routinely referred to as epigenetics. You're all familiar with that. But the particular examples of the power of lifestyle over genetic expression, I think, are germane to that discussion. So this paper, for example, by my friend Dean Ornish and others, looked at 30 men with prostate cancer and actually didn't study the men and didn't really study the cancer in the men, but rather studied the genes in the men with cancer, put them on the intensive lifestyle intervention for which Dr. Ornish is rightfully famous, and what they observed was 500 cancer promoter genes were downregulated by the lifestyle intervention, and 50 cancer suppressor genes were upregulated. Now, whether that rises to the level of rewriting our fate at the level of our genes through a lifestyle intervention or not, I leave to your own cogitation. But clearly, there is the potential to govern genetic expression, and the genetic hand we're dealt can, to one degree or another, be reshuffled by lifestyle. So part of my response. Then there was also this question about individualizing, and I'd like to address that. First, in terms of addressing this with regard to a high-risk population, frankly, increasing proportions of the global population are at fairly high risk if we're talking about obesity. In the U.S., alas, the epicenter of the global obesity pandemic, rates are continuing to rise. So as bad as the news is, we are actually moving our cooking goose from the frying pan into the fire, it seems. And Shariki Kumanyika, among others, have done projections looking at the persistence of current trends, and those projections suggest that should we stay on our current track, by 2048, every adult in the United States of America will be overweight or obese. So that's where we're headed. So, again, we certainly can assign to risk gradation, but everyone is, to one degree or another, in the at-risk group, apparently. And then the notion that actually Laurette raised about, you know, maybe we need to think about the failure in our current policy responses because they're not getting the job done. Well, there are actually two potential explanations. Either we're doing the wrong thing, or we simply haven't done enough. So think of this metaphor, for example. Let's say we're not doing the wrong thing. But let's say we do an intervention that is intended to hold back the flood tide of obesogenic factors in modern society. And frankly, the proximal cause of epidemic obesity is adverse use of feet and forks. Period, end of story. That's the proximal cause. But the root cause is everything about modern living that makes it modern. So if we consider modern living the obesogenic flood tide, and we then take soda out of schools and look around to see if all the kids are lean and healthy, they're not. And if we say, okay, that wasn't an adequate solution, let's abandon that strategy and maybe do a worksite wellness intervention and look around and see if all the employees are now lean and healthy, they won't be either. And of course, you see where the sequence of slides is going. If the intent of our collective policy efforts is to withhold an obesogenic flood tide, our feet will not be dry until the levee tops the floodwaters. It doesn't matter how much we do or how good it is. If the floodwater is higher than the levee, water will continue to pour over. Right? So, frankly, we may be doing all the right things, but we haven't done nearly enough to reverse the situation and turn the tide. I think there's a bit of truth in both directions. I don't think we're doing all the right things. And I think even when we start doing all the right things, we're going to need to do an awful lot of them and do them very well before we actually see these ominous trends reverse. My principal mission here today is to talk about what I think is a particularly good sandbag in this levee, one strategy for combating these trends, and a very practical tool which, after multiple trips to Montreal and Quebec City and recently Saskatchewan, and I hope eventually we may actually do something with this together. And the argument for this particular tool, I think, begins here. We say knowledge is power. It's not true. We've known for two decades or more what the power of lifestyle is over health, that tobacco use, poor diet, lack of physical activity are the master levers of bad fate. We haven't changed that, so knowing clearly isn't sufficient. We also tend to say, where there's a will, there's a way. And frankly, that's baloney also, because many people have a will to be thin, but they're not thin. They don't know the way. So we need to be thinking not only about willpower, but skill power. What skills do people need that they don't have? And if I may invoke pop culture, Spider-Man gave us, with great power comes great responsibility. The public health practice corollary to that is, if we're going to ask people to take responsibility for the pursuit of health, we must empower them to do so. So I begin by showing how disempowered people are. And some of you have perhaps seen these slides before. I apologize for redundancy. If so, four products on every supermarket shelf, certainly in the U.S., probably here in Canada as well. If we match these products for calorie level and look at the sodium content, it is highest in the breakfast cereal, next highest in the chocolate drink, then the corn chips, then the potato chips. Now, are there other clinicians in the room? Docs or nurses take care of patients? So if you take care of hypertensives, as I do, I assume you tell them you have to watch your sodium intake. It's fine to shop the salty snack aisle, but stay the hell away from oat-based cereals, right? Because if you don't tell them that, how are they supposed to figure it out? Currently, that's what we leave them to do. Figure it out on your own. And it gets worse. We match these two products for calories, and we look at added sugar. Yes, indeed, it's higher in the pasta sauce. Those of us who treat diabetics certainly tell them if they get a hankering for a hot fudge sundae, go for it. But if they see a jar of marinara sauce, they should run for their lives, right? And if we don't tell them that, how are they supposed to figure that out? And it gets one step worse than this, because neither of those products said anything specific about health, but this one does. Who buys low-fat peanut butter? Nobody thinking it's going to taste better. A choosy mom chooses low-fat peanut butter because, A, her kids will eat it, and, B, she thinks it's better for them. But she is wrong. When you look holistically at these two products, the nutritional profile is considerably better for the regular peanut butter. The fat-reduced peanut butter, first of all, takes out some healthy unsaturated oil, but secondly, it adds sugar, adds salt, halves the fiber, and on it goes. This message calls out to the health-conscious shopper, choose me, and it misleads her. And furthermore, you pay extra for the fat-reduced peanut butter because you're willing to pay more for the more nutritious product. So you are duped, and you spend more for the privilege, the addition of insult to injury, and part of the reason for the prevailing urban legend that more nutritious food invariably costs more. Because a lot of it isn't more nutritious food. It's just labeled as more nutritious food, and you can then charge more for it because people particularly interested in more nutritious food will go out of their way to pay for it. But the whole thing is something of a hoax. How do you fix it? GPS for the food supply, right? We don't leave people out there lost and confused. Minimally, we give them maps and compasses and teach them how to use them. But these days, we rely on modern technology. We bounce beams off satellites, and it says, turn left here. But we need GPS for the food supply. And the Nouvelle story, which some of you have heard, really begins in 2003 when I proposed that to the federal authorities in the U.S. in a meeting with the Secretary of Health and the Commissioner of the FDA. They didn't do it, but these people did. This is the group that convened to develop this system. We worked together for 2 years to develop the overall nutritional quality index algorithm. And for those of you who know the nutrition space, this is obviously a recognizable list of names. David Jenkins, the inventor of the glycemic index from Toronto, the rest of the gang from all throughout the United States, are really luminaries in nutrition and public health. The algorithm is pretty sophisticated. It includes a lot of nutrients. And by the way, I confess to you, as we begin work on Anki 2.0, it can still be improved. And that's not disheartening and shouldn't surprise you, just as we expect new releases of iPhones, Blackberries, and Windows. Even if something is pretty good, we can make it better. We can make this better, and I'm looking at approximately 6 tweaks to the engineering that will make the algorithm even better across the full expanse of the food supply. But it contains more detail than any other nutrition profiling system on the planet, and the algorithm is indeed somewhat complicated. The process for generating scores is also a bit elaborate because this engine feeds on a fuel that's richer than the nutrition facts panel. And I won't belabor this, although I'll be happy to answer questions about it, but it's relevant for policy considerations. If you want to develop a GPS system and you need the satellite beam, you need to source that. Well, in the case of NuVal, what we need is a pretty rich feed of nutrient data. So we have a whole team of dietitians using proprietary imputational software, taking the ingredient list and the nutrition facts and, in essence, reverse engineering the recipe to generate a full string of nutrients. We then back out the imputed values for what's on the nutrition facts panel, put those back in, use the imputed values for everything else. That flows through the algorithm, and what pops out the other side is a NuVal score. So, under the hood, complicated, but at the user interface, I don't think it could be any simpler because a NuVal score is 1 to 100. The higher the number, the more nutritious the food. GPS for the food supply. Turn left here. And this, by the way, showed that the regular peanut butter scored about a 20 and the fat-reduced peanut butter scored about a 7. So hard to get confused about that. The higher the number, the more nutritious the food. So this cuts right through the Madison Avenue nonsense. These are some representative scores. These are some more. Produce aisle, of course, is where the hundreds tend to reside, as you would expect. Here's some more. What's relevant here is the very impressive range, and I don't know that we have the retail industry represented here, but if we did, they could take solace in the fact that their salty snack aisle offers a very wide range of nutritional quality. Their cereal aisle does as well. Their bread aisle does as well. So, frankly, all this does is encourage shoppers to trade up within categories where they're already making choices. And by the way, I didn't prepare slides today for the sake of brevity addressing the impasse with fruit and vegetable intake, but I trust you've seen some of the recent press as well as research on that topic. We're going nowhere. We're going absolutely nowhere. 1.5% of the population south of your border meets the guidelines for fruit and vegetable intake, and that's despite counting orange juice as a fruit and both French fries and the ketchup poured over it independently as vegetables. 1.5%. It's going nowhere. Now, we shouldn't stop encouraging people to eat more produce, clearly, but empowering people to improve their diets one well-informed choice at a time within categories of food they're already eating seems like a pretty good addition to our strategy. One would expect that the staples of some of the world's healthiest cuisines would in turn be healthy, and indeed they are. The salad greens in the Mediterranean diet, the lentils. I recently spoke in Saskatchewan to the Canadian Special Crops Association. We talked about lentils and beans and field peas. I don't think I knew what a field pea was until then. Chickpeas, whole oats, salmon, avocado, berries, walnuts, almonds, Greek yogurt, all excellent scores as one would expect. The other thing to consider here is this empowers not only the choice of foods standing alone, but foods incorporated into recipes. A hamburger scores a 5. Make it out of lean ground turkey, it scores a 20. Use my wife's delicious recipe, blend the lean ground turkey with pureed lentils. This really is delicious, by the way. 34, pretty darn good. By the way, one other thing to note, my predecessor was speaking about brain signals and satiety. I think the holy grail for us who want to fix this through food rather than through pharmacotherapy or rewiring the brain is to provide people foods that fill them up on fewer calories. Here's an example. These lentil turkey burgers, and I don't want to digress too long into the cat's family dinner, but they're really delicious, and I work out pretty hard every day. I've got a hearty appetite. I sit down to these things, and every time I'm convinced I'm going to have 3. I cannot eat more than one. And it has a lot to do with the high fiber content. When you make a burger from lots of lentils, it's just very, very filling. Reduces the number of calories it takes before you really have to stop eating. And frankly, people will not deprive themselves forever. But if we can take that out of the equation by directing them toward foods that fill them up on fewer calories, that is a more sustainable strategy. Does this measure matter? Well, we published a couple of papers to which you can help yourselves, one in the American Journal of Health Promotion, one in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, where we've looked at the correlation between NuVal scores and pooled expert opinion, extremely high correlation. We also showed that NuVal scores differentiate between a more wholesome and less wholesome diet. We scored a typical American diet, and we scored the DASH diet, and there was a wide splay there, as one would hope, DASH diet scoring much higher. But most relevant, I think, is a study done not by us, but by Walter Willett and a team at the Harvard School of Public Health. Over 100,000 men and women, every food they ate was scored using NuVal. And over a 20-year span, those scores were correlated against all-cause mortality and total chronic disease. Not only was there a significant association, the higher the scores, the lower the risk of dying of anything, but Nouvel actually outperformed the Healthy Eating Index 2005. This was presented at Experimental Biology last year by a postdoc in Dr. Willett's lab, Stephanie Shiu, and it's currently, I believe, in press at the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. We also have preliminary data I didn't bring showing that the needle moves at the point of purchase. People are indeed trading up to higher scoring items within categories. This is Dr. Shiu's poster from Experimental Biology. I'd like to briefly hint at the policy potential here by noting a grant we submitted, we being a large group throughout the states, currently under review by USDA. We'll learn the fate of this grant in November. It's a $25 million grant. If we get it, we'll be intervening in 8 states. We would be putting Nouvel into schools in all 8 states. Nouvel's already in supermarkets in all 8 states, but the real innovation is this. There are more and more participants in the food assistance program in the states, formerly food stamps, now called SNAP, because of the recession. Well, what if, and those same people, by the way, in the states, their insurance typically is government insurance, it's Medicaid. And we know their diets are poor, obesity rates are high, they're extremely expensive in terms of health care. Well, what if we financially incentivize the selection of more nutritious food from soup to nuts? We've got an objective measure of nutritional quality, and we basically say, let's take the bread aisle for someone in the SNAP program. If they buy a bread in the bottom quartile of Nouvel scores, a dollar's worth a dollar. If they buy the next quartile up, a dollar stretches to $1.25. They go all the way up to the top quartile, a dollar stretches to $2, because frankly, it'll cost a lot less to incentivize more nutritious food choices than it does to care for diabetes and heart disease. And we have two of the world's leading health economists, Eric Finkelstein and Ken Thorpe, involved in doing an analysis, assuming we get funded, to demonstrate exactly that as a basis for national policy. Spend more money on incentivizing nutritious food, less money on the emergency room and CCU. So I think there are far-reaching policy implications of such a method. This slide, just briefly to note that we've actually looked at this issue of cost and nutrition. And I said earlier, without any data to back me up, that there's urban legend in the notion that more nutritious food has to cost more. We've actually studied it. We have a paper in press at Public Health Nutrition. That's just what we found. It's a lack of skill power. When you can reliably find more nutritious food in every category, you find some of it that doesn't cost more. In terms of the contempo here, Nouvel is currently live in 850 supermarkets in 25 states. It will be in over 1,000 throughout the U.S. by the end of the year. And Kroger is piloting it in Lexington, Kentucky for another month or two. Kroger has 2,500 stores in 39 states, so we're waiting to hear about a decision as to whether or not they'll roll out. If they do, the numbers get very big very fast. It's also in some public schools. There are also some relationships with the insurance industry, a relationship I just saw announced today with the American Council of Exercise, and the two organizations are working together. And that wraps up my time and my comments. I thank you for your attention.